Whether you're a world-class athlete or a podcaster like me, we all understand the importance of mental and physical well-being and proper recovery for top-notch performance. That's why I'm excited that Unified Healing is sponsoring podcasts on the Blue Wire Network. Unified Healing is a new and super innovative global network of wellness centers powered by Energy Enhancement System, or EE System. If you haven't heard of the EE System yet, then you'll want to listen up. This technology promotes wellness, deep relaxation, purification, and rejuvenation. Wherever you are across the globe, access to a center is easy and affordable. Interested in experiencing the EE System technology for yourself? Go to unifiedhealing.com/bluewire to learn more and find a center near you. That's Unified, U-N-I-F-Y-D, healing.com/bluewire. No material or testimonials on the Unified Healing website are intended to be viewed as medical advice or a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified healthcare provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition or treatment and before undertaking a new healthcare regimen, including EE System.
What's up, y'all? It's Drewski, and I've teamed up with Mountain Dew to produce a hilarious new basketball podcast called The Dew Zone with Drewski. Learn the backstories of your favorite ballers and celebrities like Jamal Murray.
Did you have, like, a favorite team? Was it the Raptors at the time or no? Was the Raptors even started around that time?
Come on, bro.
I ain't that old, fam. You're talking like I'm 50.
Taylor Rooks, Asia Wilson, and many more. You won't want to miss this. Listen to The Dew Zone with Drewski on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome to In the Know, the Bourbon Street Shots podcast. Your hosts are Michael McNamara and me, Ryan Schwan. It's all Pelicans, all the time.
Once again, Michael and I are stuck recapping after a loss. It seems to be always the case. Maybe if we just stop this podcast, the Pelicans will never lose again. But I'm not sad at all. Like, these past four games, I've had a lot of fun watching them. Michael, how do you feel about this 3-1 record?
So we're not counting, when you say having fun, we're not counting the Denver game, right?
No, I even had fun in the Denver game.
Oh, you're a masochist. No, I mean, I'm actually glad we're doing this podcast tonight as opposed to yesterday. I actually feel better about this Pelicans team after a loss against Dallas than I did after that Denver game. But yeah, overall, wins, heart, resiliency, like even tonight against Dallas, I think they could have thrown in the towel in the third, at the beginning of the fourth when they went down 14, but they stuck in it as an undermanned team on the second night of a back-to-back, and they looked like they were very upset when they lost that game. Like, these guys look like they expect to win every game, and that's a huge step for this team. I don't know how you can't, you know, fall in love with this team, what it's been doing lately.
Yeah, the Denver game in particular, I got some definite opinions of what I was watching there and just my general feeling about the two different teams, but we'll get to that when we get to Denver. This whole, you know, little, well, I guess it's actually, it was a 5-game winning streak until they lost tonight, because Miami was the first one. But that game in Brooklyn, first off, did you think with all those injuries, did you think we were going to take down Brooklyn with, it felt like, as little trouble as we did?
Yeah, I was about 50-50. Mostly I would say, yeah, because of the matchup. Brooklyn was a team that I felt like we could score in the paint against, and to me, those are always the teams I feel good against when I know Tyreek is going to have such a heavy workload. But I will not forget about, I mean, it couldn't have been more than 3 minutes into the game. My wife's watching it with me, and she just straight out, you know, says, Brooklyn looks like they don't give a blank.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't until, I mean, when Thaddeus Young and Brook Lopez and Jack came in, that kind of changed a little bit. But those guys who started, specifically Joe Johnson and Deron Williams, like, it was a bunch of dribbling around and then jacking up an 18 to 20 footer. They looked like they didn't care one bit. So yeah, I was very confident, you know, for most of that game. And yeah, I thought it was a good matchup. But did I expect Quincy Pondexter to go off for 25? Not in a million years.
Yeah. I mean, it's career high. So clearly it's not that often that he does that.
He does average 25 points a game when he's wearing a mic for Fox Sports New Orleans. So
it's true.
That is his average.
So, what I think is really funny is that Brooklyn team, is there more of a throwback team in existence in the NBA than that Brooklyn? Like, they really are as like a pure ISO team. Other than Thaddeus Young, there is nobody on that team who's or maybe in Mason Plumlee, I'll be fair, who's really interested in moving off the ball and trying to, you know, generate open looks for themselves. It is pure my turn, your turn, next guy's turn. We're not, and even Thaddeus Young in that game, they were posting him up whenever they could against Luke Babbitt. I mean, it was 100%. It felt like they were just calling one guy's number and it's his turn. And Lionel Hollins, he gets a little bit of a bad rap, but in Memphis he wasn't like that. So is it just like, is that what Joe Johnson and Deron Williams is all they can do now? Is that all Jarrett Jack's worth is just an ISO play for himself?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that they're guys who want to drive, kick, and whip it around the perimeter. I think
they had 13 assists in the entire game.
Yeah, I think in some ways it's kind of an easier style to play, you know, for older guys. So. Yeah, and I mean, Joe Johnson, he did all right in the second half, but man, I mean, I always try to think of it, if I'm a new fan to the NBA and I don't know any of the history and this is my first season watching, like if I'm that guy and I just started watching Deron Williams this year, like to me, I'm thinking he's a bottom five point guard in the league and I don't know how we've gotten here with him. I mean, yeah. Granted, the point guard position is very good now, and maybe being the bottom five isn't an insult, but this was a guy who there were honest debates, you know, him or CP3 for years, and people were on both. I mean, Kenny Smith stayed on the Deron Williams bandwagon. He was on it at the beginning and stayed on it for years and years. There were legitimate people on the Deron Williams side, and now I honestly feel like he's a bottom five point guard in the league. I don't know how we've got here.
Yeah, he broke out a couple of his old break-off dribbles, but then he would miss. He'd clank the shot. He wouldn't let. I mean, he used to do those break-off dribbles, get guys going the wrong way, and then drive the other way and score. And now it's just, okay, I did my awesome one move that still can, you know, shake guys every once in a while. And then he jacks a two-pointer from distance. It's kind of depressing watching him, and you wonder how much of it is injuries and how much of it is just he's lost interest. People do lose interest, and in some ways I feel like that's the case for him. Like, when was the last time like you felt like Deron Williams really cared about basketball? It was in Utah, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, maybe at the beginning in Brooklyn, but yeah, I mean, he seems to have gotten his money, his body's beat up. Chris Paul, even if his body betrayed him, he would never let himself become this. Mm-hmm. Like, he would find a way through it, just, you know, with the mental toughness, find a way to stay a top flight player. I truly believe that. So I don't know what happened, but yeah, maybe it was the whole getting having Shark Tank chosen over him. Just does something to a man's soul. But I mean, with Brooklyn, there were guys coming off the bench that were clearly the superior players to the guys starting. And I mean, I get this. A fully healthy Pelicans team brings Tyreek off the bench, brings Rhino off the bench. But it's, you know, it's kind of to spread out, you know, the offensive firepower. I mean, what do you think about Brooklyn's strategy with some of the guys that they brought off the bench and, you know, dug themselves a hole because that starting unit was just so abysmal?
Well, Plumlee had a pretty bad game. I don't really understand why Plumlee is starting over Lopez. I know that Lopez and Hollins actually have had a rough go of it, which is why Lopez was on the trade market, as well as the fact that he has bad feet that could break at any moment. But, I mean, I know why Darren Williams is starting, because if Darren Williams wasn't starting, you would have the worst locker room cancer around. And Jack is perfectly willing to come off the bench, so, you know, who cares if Darren Williams starts, and as long as Jack gets the 30 minutes he needs. Thad Young, like,
over Alan Anderson? I mean, they're basically starting Alan Anderson at the four, or Joe Johnson. I don't know which one was starting at the four in that game, but
yeah,
starting Alan Anderson or Markell Brown over Thaddeus Young as your four?
It is weird, but I don't know. Maybe I'll give the benefit of the doubt and say Thaddeus Young hasn't been there that long, and maybe they think he's still learning stuff. But, right, like, Thaddeus Young is clearly a superior player to either of those guys, and, you know, I would say I would play the, well, they're looking for shooting, that's why they have, but Markell Brown can't shoot.
No.
So maybe it was like they thought that Tyreke Evans was such a monster that they needed Markell Brown out there to guard him. I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, he did give Tyreke Evans trouble here and there with his physicality and made Tyreke actually have to focus in a little more than sometimes he has to.
Yeah, look, I'm not complaining. I'm not a Brooklyn fan. I'm glad that they lost that game, but it was just... It was head-scratching to me, and on our side, I mean, we overcame an abysmal Eric Gordon game. I mean, it really does. Like, I think on the last podcast, I called him the guard version of Ryan Anderson this year. It really does seem that way. I mean, he actually grabbed some boards and, you know, dished out some assists in this game, but the turnovers were there again, and the shooting was awful. But, I mean, we just had fantastic games again from Pondexter, Ajinsa, Norris Cole, Luke Babbitt efficiency. I mean, it's, you know, Ashik at a fan. I mean, it's all these guys. Cunningham. I mean, I can't say the only two guys who I would say had, you know, below par games were Tyreke Evans and Eric Gordon. It's really amazing the role players stepping up for this team.
Yeah. And even Tyreke Evans, well, overall, he was ill, too, for this game. While overall, I would say he had a fairly poor game, he still had his moments. Like, he had, like, a nice little six-minute stretch a couple times where he played pretty well, and then he kind of vanished again or got into trouble. The role players, like, this is the kind of stuff that I got to be so careful, like, in the way I, like, start thinking things, because these role players could look really solid when they're put into long, big, extensive roles. And then I start thinking, well, we've got like, oh, well, our big guys come back. We've got like a 10-deep team now. We're going to be like unstoppable. And some of these guys, if you look at their numbers, they feel like they're really impressive. Like, you look at Dante Cunningham, and he put up a 13-7 in this on 11 shots. That's pretty solid. But you give any average forward in the NBA 33 minutes, and they're probably going to come pretty close to 13-7. So it is nice that he's putting up average forward numbers for a team that, you know, basically other than Ryan Anderson had no forwards who were doing anything early in at the beginning of the season. But we do need to be careful that we're not thinking that, like, this guy is suddenly going to be like a difference maker when it really matters necessarily.
Yeah. The other thing I'll admit that I'm a little worried about is, so we see a team like Atlanta just completely take off. And I think part of the reason why is, you know, people say one of the worst things about them is they have no superstar. To me, that's one of the best things, because when Damari Carroll has an open shot, he doesn't for a second think, oh, maybe I shouldn't take this because we got to get the superstar 20 shots a game. Like, everybody feels like an equal on some levels there, and you just let it go. And, you know, watching this team play, I don't see the hesitancy in Luke Babbitt's shot. I definitely don't see the hesitancy anymore in Eric Gordon's shot, for better or worse. I see a bunch of guys who go, okay, I'm open, or I have the mismatch, I'm taking the shot. And I just, I guess I worry a little bit. You know, you get three very high usage, big names, you know, players that we have actual plays for in our playbook, guys back in Drew and Ryan Anderson and Anthony Davis. I guess, you know, I would be a little worried that, you know, maybe these guys shrink a little bit because of that, because they know that those are the guys that we have to feed and those are our stars, which I'm not saying is going to necessarily make the team worse because doing that is a good thing, especially if those guys are on. I'm just saying from an individual standpoint, I don't know if I'm fully expecting these guys to be as efficient on a permanent basis as they are right now. What do you think about that?
I am 100% on board with you, and I was waiting until we talked to Denver to do my little spiel about this, but I think I'll jump ahead. So watching, especially against Denver, it seemed to be more stark and like right out in front of me, because essentially we were watching the Pelicans play a junk offense. Like Denver's, their offense is what I would consider a junk offense. In a lot of ways, it felt like kind of what we saw last year when Tyreek Evans and Eric Gordon and Drew Holiday, none of them were really on the same page, and they were all playing me, and the ball wasn't necessarily going to Davis, and it was all like, it's my turn. And what happened when you watch Denver was, and they got lucky, they were hitting shots, and they were getting successful on their drives and hitting some of those too, but there's not really plays where guys are second or any more than second option. They run a play, there's the primary guy, he may or may not pass it, and that second guy, he's shooting it. Or they're going to reset, and that guy's going to pump fake, move the ball around, try to figure some way to drive and to get his own thing going. There is no real multi-option plays in the Denver offense at all. And watching the Pelicans against that team, it felt like I was watching, and this is, bear with me for a second, the San Antonio Spurs without any star power at all.
Mm.
Maybe a better example would be the Indiana Pacers right now. It was basically a team that was just 100% playing the system. There wasn't any dude who was going to be like, me. The ball was going to move. They had their two guys who were going to break down, and then they were going to start kicking the ball around if they couldn't get to the rim. And nobody was like, oh, well, the ball didn't work, we got to call this back and reset it and feed it to this dude again who's our star, like you just said. It really felt like I was watching good team basketball, which is a feeling I haven't felt since they had Chris Paul on the team. And they would actually have moments where maybe Chris Paul wasn't the primary option running a pick and roll. They had moments where the ball moved around, and you could see, like, feel that. Like, Tyson Chandler and David West had some nice moments down low, and Peja could be getting into it. It felt like this team had a system that they trusted, and they were just going to work through it. And even Tyreek Evans, like, these games, if Davis goes down, you kind of have a feeling, well, Tyreek Evans will feel like he needs to take over. Tyreek Evans is averaging, I think, 16 shots per game this season. He averaged 13.5 over the stretch. He didn't suddenly feel like he needed to take over. And they just moved the ball around. They got open shots. If the guy didn't have the clearest open shot, he moved the ball to the next dude. And when I'm going to start murdering Ryan Anderson for the next, like, 30 seconds. So if you're a Ryan Anderson fan, just hit the pause. And skip ahead a little bit. One of the number one problems with Anderson is he is the designated finisher. Like, everybody knows that once the ball hits Ryan Anderson's hand, he's going to try to be finishing it. This season, he's been very inefficient. And if you take a look at his numbers compared to every season in the past, he is not efficient at all this season. So when a guy who's been designated as a finisher isn't being efficient, he's not giving you the points you need, and the ball does not move past him ever, you're short-circuiting that whole ability. Davis is in some respects the same way. Like, we see a ton of mid-range jumpers, and we've been seeing a couple of them. Like, tonight we saw a lot of them from Dante Cunningham, but in a lot of situations, we're not seeing a lot of those mid-range jumpers. Can you remember, other than Dante Cunningham, anybody on this team over the last four games short-circuiting any sort of play or running a pick-and-roll where it's a pick-and-pop to a guy at the mid-range?
Maybe a Jinsa once or twice, but not that much, no.
So those guys have, like, there's this idea that I'm setting a pick-and-pop, I'm a finisher, ball reaches me, I must shoot. But in such situations, I think that's, like, the wrong thing. We need to be, like, I want Davis to get the ball, and he's extremely effective, but he's not necessarily that effective even when he's shooting mid-range, even though he's got a good number there. Like, Davis is less so because he's more efficient, so you can have a designated finisher like Davis because he's more efficient. But when it's Anderson being the designated finisher, even Drew Holiday is not that efficient being the designated finisher, you've got issues. And I'd rather have a guy who doesn't feel he is the designated finisher like we're seeing right now.
So let me ask you this, just to more play devil's advocate. I don't even really know how I feel on this, but there's a 5-game winning streak. Whenever there's a winning streak, people assume everything's going right. When there's a losing streak, everything's going wrong. But obviously the truth is more in the middle. This 5-game winning streak was 2 wins against Miami, 1 against Brooklyn, 1 against Denver, and 1 against Toronto that is on a 5-game losing streak, not playing well at all. Let's say the Pels play, you know, about the same way, same guys or whatever, but this is, you know, a 5-game stretch where the competition is, let's say, at least average or slightly above, not 4 teams well below 500 and a 5th team that's, you know, hit a rut in their season. I mean, I guess I just struggle to associate it being as simple as wins equal the team is playing good and we've got to keep it like this. Losses means drastic changes are needed. It's never that simple for me. I guess I want to know how much you think the 5-game winning streak was the Pelicans finding something that they do well and, you know, success that could be success for the future and that you expect to sustain, and how much of it was that a lot of the games were at home, or, you know, 3 of the games were at home, and at least 4, if not all 5 of the games were against bad teams.
I would say about 70% of it was the fact that they were playing poor teams. It was a soft part of the schedule. I'm 100% certain that had Anthony Davis been playing in these games, we would be probably have been beating them, and they would have been more blowouts, and all of them were fairly close, like at least moderately close. And if Anthony Davis had been there, I think we would have torched them. But there is some very good things that we saw here, like the way Monty was handling those rotations and just the ability he has right now to sub players out just to do different things and provide matchups, and the fact that Alexa Jinsa has, you know, finally managed to control his fouling enough that he can play half a game and be super effective is really big. And the fact that Norris Cole, although he's still cringeworthy with his shot selection at times, has been a very impactful guard. I mean, nothing could be more clear, to me at least, at how crappy our backup guards have been than Norris Cole coming in and just showing how crappy they've been. I mean, like, we seriously have had some bad, bad backup guards for a really long time. Like, the only guy who even is in the same zip code as Norris Cole as a contributor was Jarrett Jack.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely better. I don't want to take any credit away from these guys. I don't want to act like, you know, we shouldn't be excited. I guess my, like I'm saying, remember, I mean, people, I just see a lot of people saying we're playing better with these guys down. I mean, we were without Drew, Rhino, and Anthony Davis for that Indiana game where they got embarrassed, and, you know. Same for, we lost to Utah two nights before that. I mean, do you think that we're competitive or win that Indiana game the way we've been playing? I mean, have these guys gotten that much better, or was it, you know, a scheduled thing? I kind of lean towards you. I think Cole has definitely helped. That's somebody we didn't have before the All-Star break. And a couple of guys have played a little better, but, you know, I wasn't ready to, you know, overreact and get all excited against what I thought was wins against five teams that were playing poorly at the moment. That said, a win is a win, and if the Pels, you know, had any hopes for the playoffs, they needed to run off a stretch like this and, you know, stay afloat while their big three guys are down, and now it looks like Anthony Davis could be back anytime soon.
Yeah. So let me ask you. So we have all these guys to choose from. Did anybody really surprise? Like, and you can't use Norris Cole because he wasn't on the team. Only guys who we've been watching for a significant portion of the season. So it could be a Sheik, Cunningham, anybody, Pondexter, Babbitt, Ajinsa. Did any of these guys, like, surprise you with their play? Did you think that some of these guys just couldn't do some of the stuff they were showing in these four games, and now maybe you're reevaluating them?
I mean, Ajinsa's consistency, it's something Monty said before one of the games, is that he was always skilled. Just last year he wasn't really conditioned, and, you know, the hardest thing with him has been the consistency. We're looking at a five-game stretch where really, I mean, what was his worst game in this stretch? Maybe the game at Denver, but even in that game, I mean, he was basically our go-to guy for a huge stretch, you know, in that fourth quarter. But we're looking over the last five games, he's averaging 23 minutes, shooting 70% from the field, and basically putting up 15-8. So, yeah, I mean, I mean, he wins that Miami game for us. I mean, the announcers were raving like he was an all-star in that Miami game, and maybe rightfully so in stretches. So, yeah, I always thought, you know, he was a guy that from game to game could get you big points. And in the past we talk about, well, in this matchup he's good and, you know, against this type of guy. But he went against every type of center, every type of team in this stretch. And, yeah, he had two games where, you know, the foul troubles really bothered him. In one of the games, he had a terrible foul. Basically, we were up one late in the game, and he got an over-the-back that sent the other team to the line. I don't remember. It had to be the Miami game.
I think it was Miami, yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, he's still making some of the bonehead plays. He had, you know, nine turnovers in the Toronto and Brooklyn game combined, but... Yeah, I think the offensive efficiency, I definitely expected against certain matchups, but he looks like a guy that if you go to him game in and game out, he is going to find the way to get you buckets and, you know, at a very, very productive pace.
So here's my next step in that situation. Let's say you have the opportunity this offseason to bring back both Ajinsa and Ashik, which of course the Pelicans can do. How much money are you putting on the table for them combined? Like
13, I've already thought about 13 to 14 million. So 14 million.
Okay.
I'd definitely be willing to do that. I think I tweeted out today that, you know, since the injuries happened, those guys are putting up something like 21 and 15 on 68% shooting. In over 46 minutes, like that's otherworldly, and no, I would not expect that, especially when we get some of our high usage guys back. But I have no reason not to expect the efficiency, you know. And And I don't know. The other part that still bothers me is this team still gives up points in the paint, you know, at a ridiculous rate. And these are two guys who should be at least affecting that somewhat. And, you know, combine that with Ajinsa not necessarily being the defensive rebounder that sometimes his stats say he is. And I still have some concerns, but yeah, $14 million, which should be about 17-18% of the future cap. I'll spend 18% of my cap on these two centers. What about you? What would your numbers be?
I was thinking something along the lines of 8.5 for Ashik and 4.5 for Ajinsa. So probably about the same thing.
I mean, 8.5 for Ashik, to me, I can't see how that happened. Not with everybody know where the cap's going. I mean, 8.5 will basically be the MLE in 2 years.
Yeah. So you think he's going to cost more?
Oh, I think he'll be.
How much do you think Ajinsa's going to cost in that situation?
My guess is something like 10.5 and 3.5 or 11 and 3. I mean, you know, we see Ajinsa like this, but I mean, Anthony Davis is going to come back, and Ajinsa's minutes per game are going to go back down. I mean, as a GM, you're going to see, you know, a guy who will be 27 at the time, who averaged about 12 minutes a game, like full.
Yeah, but
full,
are Ajinsa's minutes going to go down, or are Dante Cunningham's minutes going to go down?
Well, I mean, I mean, we've seen DNPs from Ajinsa with our big guy, with when all three guys are healthy. You know, we've never seen that with Cunningham. So, yeah, I mean, full MLEs go to, you know, right or wrong, Spencer Hawes and, you know, and Chris Kamens and stuff like that. And I can't imagine him getting a full MLE offer. So, yeah, I think $3-3.5 million. And, you know, hopefully he'll look at us as the team that, you know, gave him the shot back in the league and likes being here. I think something like 3 years, $11 million. Is a very fair deal for both parties, gives him some security. And, you know, I mean, that's like the Spurs way. I said those numbers because that's what the Spurs gave Danny Green when he first showed some signs of being a legit NBA player after they basically saved him from the D League. And, you know, it was a good deal for both parties. So I think something like that is reasonable. I think for Ashik, we're looking at something like 4 years, $42 million.
Yeah. And here's the number one reason why I like the idea of those two guys. And it's beyond just the fact that having Ashik there as the defensive specialist and Ajinsa as the offensive specialist at the center, that's actually really nice. And, you know, we can limit Ashik's minutes because I'm still 100% of the belief if he plays more than half the game, he's playing suboptimally for some of it. So if you can have Ajinsa come in and take like 20 to 24 minutes from him, that's a good thing. But that allows Anthony Davis to stay 100% power forward. He doesn't have to mix it up with big dudes as much as he is right now. It allows him to roam more freely. But what do you think that does? Like, if you are Dell Demps and you now have the situation and you decided and you already have it in the books, I am committed to Omer Ashik and Ajinsa for $13.5 million for the next, you know, 3 years. Now I look at the rest of my team. My center spot's locked down. That's all 48 minutes of my center, really. Maybe you can squeeze like 4 to 8 minutes out somewhere else if you needed to.
I mean, I would say even in this stretch, they're only playing 46. I don't even know if you would ask for 48 from those two, but yeah, go ahead.
Okay. You're now looking at a team that has Anthony Davis, who's not going to play very minutes of center, or if he does, it's going to be 2 to 4 minutes a game. Maybe you get generous and give him 8. So that means he has 28 minutes at the power forward position. That's 20 minutes left at power forward. And you have your hands on Dante Cunningham and Ryan Anderson. Are you looking to move those guys this summer, no matter what?
Yeah, I mean,
are you,
this
like,
is
like, what are you considering at this point?
This is the interesting question, and like, this is the quote unquote problem with so many guys playing well. I mean, I'd say problem in quotes, obviously, because it's a good problem to have. But yeah, I mean, if this team is fully healthy, Babbitt's not getting any minutes. Dante Cunningham, you're struggling to find places to play him, and you're probably playing him the three out of position. You know, Ajinsa is going from 23 minutes down to maybe 8, maybe DNPs. I mean, this is the quote-unquote problem with having, you know, so many guys who are, you know, somewhat productive, and it is an issue that Dell and Monty are going to have to, you know, figure out this summer if both stay and are planning to stay long term. I don't know. I see so many things. I mean, first of all, one part of me is honestly a little worried. Like, the Dante Cunninghams of the world, the Luke Babbitts of the world, the Alexei Ajinsas of the world, they could definitely win you and help you win regular season games. But when we talk about the playoffs, you narrow your rotation down to 8, and it's the big time players that win you games. So, you know, in some ways over the course of a season, I could see an argument for a bunch of these role player scrappy guys that we all fall in love with. But in the playoffs, everybody is playing hard and they have talent. We see this every year with like Scott Skiles coach teams or Tom Thibodeau coach teams or whatever. They outwork everybody during the regular season, and that works. But in the playoffs, when people have rest and there's a single focus and everybody's locked in, like, you're not going to outwork teams. Everybody's working hard and teams have elite talent. So I don't know. It's kind of tough, but part of me leans towards, no, you don't get cute with it. You keep as many, you know, elite level guys as possible. And Ryan Anderson was not elite in any way. Actually, he was elite at home. But I am one of the, it seems like, very few believers out there who believe that a second year back after injury, a full summer of conditioning and not having to go through surgery or wondering if you'll ever play the game again, I fully expect to see the old Ryan Anderson from day one next year. So that's kind of the way I lean. I think I'm in the minority, but I lean towards keeping the elite talent over trying to get by with guys who are good enough on cheaper deals. So what about you?
I'm actually 100% behind you. I think unless there's some trade out there that clears out a logjam somewhere else and upgrades one position tremendously, I killed Ryan Anderson earlier, but you keep Ryan Anderson. As far as I mean, he's not on an expensive deal. And even if he's only getting 24 minutes a game, it's 24 minutes a game of possibly awesomeness. And I also believe that he will be better next year than he is this year. And Dante Cunningham, like I said earlier, like, there's, you can't but love the guy. I mean, he is working so hard every minute of the game out there. But even if you like look at him and say, I want to keep him, how much are you going to be spending on that guy? A couple million a year? Do you think it goes as high as 3? Like, are we talking Al-Farouq Aminu deal for Dante Cunningham? That's not breaking anything. And you can make it be like a 2-year deal with a team option for the second year. So look around. You have Ryan Anderson on a contract. Just tell Dante, look, I'm going to come back to you a little later in free agency. We really want you around. We think you're great for the team. We think you're great in the locker room. We think, you know, we love your hustle. And then you just try to find any sort of deal that might really upgrade your team, like a home run. And if you don't have it, you keep Ryan Anderson, you bring Dante back as the super elite fifth big man / small forward, and you move forward with that. Like, I'm actually more worried about the guard spots than I am right now about the big man role. I think it's great having Ryan Anderson and having a Sheik and a Jinsa as possible players. Because, I mean, once Jrue Holiday's back, like, we were already talking about how, you know, the fourth guard is usually only going to get, like, a dozen minutes, but Quincy Pondexter's playing significant minutes at the shooting guard role right now. So how does that work? Like, we can't have Tyreke Evans, Eric Gordon, Jrue Holiday, Quincy Pondexter, and Norris Cole all taking essentially 2.5 positions. That's way too much.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of crazy. It's like, if we have a healthy team and we have this somewhat useful tool in a mid-level exception, we're almost at the point of like, well, where do we use this? Because we don't really have a need that definitely, you know, needs to be filled. We're talking about not even have enough minutes for the guys that we currently like on this roster. I think most fans like about 11 players on this team. Mm-hmm. And, you know, unless the Pelicans go full San Antonio and, you know, start playing guys, you know, nobody plays
28 minutes.
Yeah, nobody plays over 30 minutes, and we're going to rest guys, which obviously we're at a different stage in our development, so that'll never happen. You know, there's not going to be enough minutes to go around. And I mean, we really haven't even talked about Babbitt, who has also been huge in this stretch. I mean, he's a guy that, I mean, if he qualifies, he could lead the league in 3-point shooting this year. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah. That's insane, and that's a guy who wouldn't even be in our rotation if fully healthy. So, yeah, there's a lot of interesting, really small decisions. I mean, we have bird rights on everybody except for Dante Cunningham. So, really, you know, aside from maybe Cunningham, anybody that we want to sign, we can. And we probably, and I mean, we could use that MLE on Cunningham. So there's really absolutely nobody that we have to lose. Like, Anthony Morrow last year, we had to lose simply because of the CBA rules. We could only, after we made the Ashik deal, we could only offer him a 2-year deal with the exception that we had. That was a 2-year exception. We couldn't offer Morrow more than 2. And Oklahoma City finally came along and said, fine, we'll give you 3. And Morrow wanted to be here, but you can't turn that down. So he left. But there is nobody on this roster that Dell cannot keep if he wants to. Anybody that is let go will be let go because we preferred somebody else. So it'll be really interesting to see, you know, how he kind of prioritizes guys and what happens. But I'm with you on Ryan Anderson. I mean, first of all, I don't think there's as many trades out there as people think there are. I think any trade you make based on, you know, his injuries the last 2 seasons, you're probably getting 60 cents on the dollar. And, you know, I just I think that there's more value in keeping him and letting him go. Once you do that, then you're honestly looking at a total of, if we sign another small forward, you're looking at maybe 20 minutes for some, you know, if for Ajinsa, Babbitt, and Dante Cunningham. So I guess my question to you is, rank those 3. Let's assume somewhat similar cost. Actually, I'll give you specific contracts. So let's assume that we bring everybody else back, Norris Cole, the Big Six, Quincy Pondexter. We also add a mid-level small forward, let's say Jared Dudley or Jay Crowder, whatever. And now...
You're not going to say Damari Carroll?
No, he's...
I know you want to.
Oh, he's outside of that. He's played himself outside of the mid... If Marvin Williams got $7 million last year, okay. Carroll's getting 8 to 10. So anyway, so we signed one of those guys, and now here you are, your Dell Demps. Rank them in order. Let's say Ajinsa, 3 years, $11.5 million. Dante Cunningham would cost you 2 years, $7 million, and Babbitt, 2 years, $5 million. Give me, rank for me the order of the guys that, you know, you would be interested in.
I would go exactly the order you presented them to me. Ejinsa, Dante, and then Babbitt.
I would...
you said 2 years, $7 million for Dante?
Yeah.
No, I put Babbitt above Dante, actually.
Yeah,
just because of the contract.
I was going to ask you, how do you get Dante Cunningham minutes on a team with Jared Dudley, Quincy Pondexter, Anthony Davis, and Ryan Anderson?
Well, how do you get Luke Babbitt minutes there? I mean, you don't. But, I mean, the reason why in a vacuum, I would go with Dante, because Dante can play in any sort of game, really. Like, he has a little bit of offensive talent, enough hustle that he's not a complete disaster offensively. He's going to give you his all defensively, and you could pretty much play him at some role against every team. Like, every team is going to have somebody who's either a power forward who he can guard or a small forward he can guard for most situations. Babbitt, there's very rarely people he can guard unless you're hiding him. And although he is just a blisteringly amazing three-point shooter, there are certain teams you just can't play Luke Babbitt. It's going to be too much of a problem defensively. And so that's why I was saying Dante ahead of him. But that contract puts him below Babbitt. Because again, we're talking like our fifth dude.
So, I mean, let me ask you this. Dell is obviously a master at the scrap heap.
Mm-hmm.
Who would be, let's say Dell lets both of them go, whose skill set would be harder to find on the scrap heap? Dante Cunningham or Luke Babbitt's?
Wow. Luke Babbitt.
Yeah, I mean, that's the way I kind of lean to, and sort of my reason for the time break. Like, I love Cunningham. The other thing about it is Babbitt, I think you could bring back and him not be an everyday rotation guy. Him playing 50 or 60 games and some days being in the rotation, some days not, and being ready to step in when when an injury happens. Can you imagine bringing Cunningham back and being like, all right, you're the fifth forward, be ready when you get a chance, after you've given him like 40 minutes in multiple games this year? I think it would be a little harder to drastically reduce Cunningham's role after this year, as opposed to, you know, I mean, Babbitt's pretty much used to it. He's used to being on the bench and when his number's called, going in, and then other days getting DNPs. That might be another reason I lead towards Babbitt as well.
And I have a question for you. Do you actually think Babbitt's going to be getting $5 million over 2 years from this team?
Maybe that's a little high, but I could see somebody throwing a biannual at him, which is like, this year I think it'll be like 2 years, four and a half. I mean, shooting is the most sought-after skill, and again, like I said, if he qualifies, which he should if Ryan Anderson stays out and he keeps getting minutes, I mean, he could be the number one or number two three-point shooter in the league. I could see a team offering him a biannual for that skill.
It's possible. For some reason, I just still see him as almost a minimum contract guy, and I would be really shocked if he got like as much as a $5 million deal. But then I was shocked when Jody Meeks got like seven a year or whatever, like crazy things. I mean, there's always Jeff Bowers running around out there somewhere signing shooters to stupid contracts.
Yeah,
so.
shooters are tough to keep on minimal deals if they do what Babbitt is doing this year. But I think it is a good problem to have. I think that no matter what Dell does, there are going to be one or two guys let go that people love, and Dell's going to catch some flack for that. But I always say he finds a way to replace those guys. I mean, Morrow really hurt to lose, and when Demps replaced him with Salmons, you know, that really hurt. But eventually he found Pondexter, and eventually he found Norris Cole, and, you know, eventually he will replace those fringe guys. It's the top of the roster where he's really got to hit home runs, and we've got to stay healthy moving forward.
Mm-hmm. All right, so did you want to talk about any of these other particular games? Like,
yeah,
we talked Brooklyn. We didn't talk. I mean, I mentioned my take of the Denver, and I felt bad for Fareed trying to handle a Sheik inside.
Yeah, I think the Miami game was somewhat interesting to me. I mean, this was the Norris Cole game. You talk about not liking the shots that Norris Cole takes at times, and people probably shake their heads because he's making them for the most part, but this was the regression to the mean game all in one, where he was taking those same inefficient shots, but now he was missing them. But they, you know, the Pelicans still found a way to overcome. I think that Gordon was fantastic in stretches, and, you know, another high energy game from Pondexter. But yeah, I don't know how you could look anywhere else than that. The pick and roll with Ajinsa and Gordon. I mean, the fact that Tyreek goes down and the Pelicans go to this pick and roll with Gordon and Ajinsa that look like Stockton to Malone was just, it was mind blowing. But they don't win this game without those two.
Yeah, I mean, Ajinsa looked like a complete and total monster out there, and this isn't the kind of team we'd actually expect. Like, in the past, I would have expected him to do that too. I always said it was lumbering centers, but Whiteside's not a lumbering center. And Chris Anderson was completely overmatched by Ajinsa in this game. Like, Chris Anderson looked like he shouldn't be playing basketball anymore. He was so bad. But part of that was just because he could not, for the life of himself, just handle Ajinsa's length. Like, Ajinsa was just jumping and getting the ball right over his head. And it was a pretty impressive effort from Ajinsa. And Eric Gordon had 8 assists in this game. He had a 20-8 line.
Yeah, I mean, his pick and roll with Ajinsa was literally unstoppable. And and yeah, I mean, you look, this was a game where Sheik and Ajinsa played exactly 48 minutes, and you're talking about 29 points on 13 shots and 18 rebounds from the I mean, nobody is getting, maybe the Clippers are close, but they're not getting the points. But nobody is getting close to the center production over 48 minutes that the Pelicans have gotten since the All-Star break.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, it's been absolutely fantastic, and it's our guards who are inconsistent and back and forth, and, you know, the three-point shots that go in some nights and not the others. But the center position for the New Orleans Pelicans since the All-Star break has been one of the most productive positions of any team in the NBA.
Yeah. I'm trying to keep myself from getting too excited about it, though. Because once Anthony Davis comes in here, like, how many of those pick and rolls are going to be for the center, I mean, Sheik or Ajinsa? Like, it's going to be Davis.
Yeah. Yeah, and even with Ajinsa on, I mean, I would still say Ajinsa on the second unit, but yeah, long-term, if Evans and Ryan Anderson are on the second unit with Ajinsa, even Norris Cole. I mean, seriously, if Ajinsa goes out there with, you know, Norris Cole, Tyreek Evans, Ryan Anderson, Dante Cunningham, and Ajinsa as the five backups for the second unit, like, how big of a focus is Ajinsa going to be on the offensive end?
Yeah. Yeah, not much of one.
Yeah, we saw the return of Michael Beasley, who I think in stretches was...
Wow, it was so nice of him to come out and play for us. Oh, wait, no, he was in Miami, was it? I forgot that he was playing for Miami because he was so helpful for the Pelicans.
Oh, he just started... I had a Twitter follower telling me that him and... about 1 o'clock in the afternoon, him and Udonis Haslam were just walking down Canal Street in their Miami Heat sweats. I mean, that's so Michael Beasley. But yeah, he was our MVP for a couple of stretches there, then of course hit some impossible shots. But and then Henry Walker hitting 25-foot bombs. I mean, it's crazy, but I mean, I think the Heat beat us in this game if Dwayne Wade sits it out. He was
a disaster.
He was really bad.
And he he jacked that three-pointer at the end. That wasn't a very good one to try to win it all.
Who do you – I mean, speaking of right before that, Ashiq gets a rebound that looks like seals us the game, throws it to Gordon, and it goes out of bounds. Who at the moment or after watching again did you put more blame on for that?
For the ball going out of bounds?
Yeah.
Ashiq.
Really?
Yeah. When I saw the replay, at first I thought it was Gordon's fault, but when I saw the replay, Gordon was starting to sprint, and he threw it kind of behind him, so Gordon had to reach back to try to grab it. Now, you could make some consideration, should Gordon be sprinting up ahead? Shouldn't he just be waiting to get the ball? But, I don't know. There wasn't any reason, I mean, Ashiq clearly wanted to get the ball out of his hands so he wasn't going to be fouled and have to shoot free throws, but he could have taken, like, a breath and then thrown a better pass than that.
Yeah, I mean, I was just so glad Wade's three did not go in, because if it did, I think Ashiq would have caught as much flack as that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm very happy with the Sheik's play, and I'm happy that Ajinsa's coming along. And I mean, it's all good things like that we've been seeing. Like even like the Dallas game, we lost that game, but I didn't feel like it was like we weren't destroyed. They played hard. They fought all the way through it. And Rajon Rondo's hitting crazy ass crap in the first quarter. Like there's no
Jefferson went back to 2002.
I don't know. Richard Jefferson does that every time to us. I remember in Utah where he just shredded us. And I don't know what it is with Richard Jefferson and being able to destroy the Pelicans. Maybe it's just Tyreke Evans, because, I mean, Tyreke Evans seemed to always be off balance when Jefferson was making a move. His, and couldn't really stay in front of him.
Tyreke's off-ball defense tonight was, I mean, if you were a coach and you wanted to show guys how to not play off-ball defense, you put in tonight's tape. I mean, he's so unaware and just ball watching. But yeah, no, I mean, it's, and I thought it was kind of fitting that, you know, role players, I mean, even Devin Harris, like they were the ones that beat us tonight. It was kind of karma for the fact that we've been going out beating all these teams with our role fringe players. So, you know, whatever, it is what it is, but it's been a good couple of weeks overall, regardless of tonight's outcome.
Yeah, the funniest play in the entire game, though, was I remember when Stoudemire played for Phoenix, and people used to kill him for his defense, and there's all kinds of defenders of Amari Stoudemire and his defense, and that he's not as bad as you think he is, and blah, blah, blah. Just, I mean, he is, you said that Tyreke Evans is unaware. Like, Stoudemire has no idea how to even play defense appropriately. And he's in his, what, like 13th, 14th year in the league? Mm-hmm. And he doesn't, like, understand the fundamentals. Just go watch his very first play on defense tonight, and you will see him hedge halfway out to the three-point line to cover a guy who has two people within reach of him, because that guy sort of took a step towards the paint, which just leaves Ajinsa open for a wide open dunk. You could not figure out any sort of mental process you could go through where that was the appropriate thing. And he's like all crouched down, and it looks like he's playing like really intent defense, but he's playing stupid defense. Like there's no logic here. It's pretty bad. He's not on our team though, even though you wanted him to be. So I should just shut up. But I wanted to kill him for a second.
Yeah, and I mean the last, you seem to feel differently about this Denver game. I promised people on Twitter I wouldn't even talk about it because it was just a very hard game for me to watch or take really anything good out of other than Ashiq's monstrous defensive rebounding. So you know
he threw Fareed around
all
game. Well, it was. Like, this is like, and I kind of agree with this. Like, people were talking about Fareed and how he's going to explode this year, and because of what he did World Championships.
Yeah.
And he just, I mean, he was doing that against like really tiny guys. And if you remember the one game we played against Turkey when Ashiq was playing center against us, Like, Ashiku's just tossing him all over the place. And it's just all that, again, like, Fareed just, he's not actually that good of a rebounder, even if you just look at his numbers. He's not the impactful athlete player that you think he is. And, well, I mean, he'd be interesting on the team. I get more and more down on Fareed all the time.
Yeah, and I don't want people to think that that the Danilo Gallinari that played against us is the real one. Right. I mean, he's been, not that he was great in this game, but he's been, you know, much worse. Spoiler alert, he doesn't hit half-court shots every game, which, you know, same in Randy Foy too. But, yeah, I'm not really a big fan of anybody on this Denver team. Like, even Wilson Chandler, I don't know. I'd rather go with some of the guys I brought up earlier, Jared Dudley, you know, Jay Crowder. I would rather have, you know, Mike Dunleavy Jr. for another year or two and wait on a bigger name small forward if we can't, you know, get somebody. I think Wilson Chandler is a guy I would have liked 2 or 3 years ago. I don't really know if I like this version of Wilson Chandler all that much.
Yeah, and half of that I wonder is just the fact he knows he's on a really crappy team and he's just not putting a lot of effort out there anymore. But, you know, Wilson Chandler, even in, like, his best prime years when he was being overhyped in New York, his numbers were average across the board. And it's like it's the same sort of thing. Like Bill Simmons has said this a couple times. Like I think it's the Kerry Kittles rule or something like that, where basically you take any wing player and you give them 30 something minutes and they're going to score 14 points for you. So don't get excited over that. That's just kind of stupid. And that's pretty much what Wilson Chandler does. He grabs 6-7 rebounds and gets you a little more than a dozen points.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't see the intangibles. I don't see the leadership. Like, that's what I'm saying with a guy like Jared Dudley. I know I'm going to get leadership with a guy like Jay Crowder. I got somebody who's hungry with a guy like Mike Dudley, you know, Jr. I know that he's going to do everything and not demand the ball. So, I mean, I'm not a huge Wilson Chandler guy anymore. Maybe 2 years ago, but not now.
You know, I thought it was the best thing. Did you watch the Denver broadcast or the Pelicans broadcast?
Pelicans.
Okay, I watched the Denver one, and they are working so hard to sell this team. It's ridiculous. They had a graphic up there where it showed Will Barton next to Aaron Aflalo, and games and points or their numbers since the trade, and how Will Barton is, like, so clearly better than Aaron Aflalo. And of course, they left out, like, the minutes per game played for each of them. It was like Aflalo's averaging, like, 9 points and 2.5 rebounds, and Will Barton's, like, 16 and 4. And he's so much better than Aaron Aflalo. I'm like, wow. And then, like, a little later, they did the exact same thing, like, they had Randy Foy up there and somebody else from another team.
Wait, what did you just call him?
Randy Foy. Okay. I probably said it wrong, but Randy Foy. I know who his name is. and it was another person that they had traded away who isn't getting any minutes where he went. And it's like, so Randy Foy off the bench, like, this was the right decision. He's so much better. It's like, wow. Like, they're just desperate at this point.
And I've been wondering the last couple of weeks, like, how stupid do announcers think NBA fans are, or producers or whatever? Because not only that, I don't know if you watched the Houston-Cleveland game the other day. But they had a whole minute section on, first of all, they called it Houston Rockets Analytics, and they broke down effective field goal percentage and why it's different than regular, like, really, who do they think their audience is, and do they not know that people have the access to internet while they're actually watching these games? Yeah, it's mind-blowing sometimes. Thank God we have Joel Myers.
Yeah, I mean, like, when I started writing for this blog, you know, people didn't use a lot of those numbers, but they've been old since, like, I mean, I would say I wrote for about a year, and I was using numbers that not a lot of people paid attention to. But after that year, John Hollinger sat on ESPN for like 5 years talking about this stuff. And if they think anybody doesn't know what true shooting percentage is, or who actually pays attention to these games and NBA more than casually, I mean, they're kidding themselves.
Yeah, no, I mean, the NBA fan is infinitely more intelligent than they were 3 years ago.
It'd be like trying to talk to a baseball fan and thinking that they're not going to know what on-base percentage is.
Oh, I mean, like, that's exactly what I made a joke. I said, you know, what's going to happen next is ESPN going to talk about Oakland A's OBPS in the next. I mean, it's we're at this world, and, like, I understand there are still some casual fans out there, but I think national media has to step their game up and talk to the obsessive fans, not the.
Which is actually, I had, you know, watching this Dallas game, it was annoying as crap listening to their stupid announcer guy, like the guy in there. Not. I wasn't watching their broadcast, but I was watching our broadcast. But the guy in the arena shouting "Let's go Mavs!" Like, that guy was the most annoying person I've ever listened to in my life. But I actually, they used to have a three-man booth for Dallas, and they had the third guy. He would actually talk like actual analytics and how people are more efficient at this. And like, he was actually pretty good, but they stopped bringing him on board. And I'm kind of bummed out about that. He was fun to listen to.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the hardcore fans got to let their voice be known more, but anyway, yeah. Coming off a loss tonight, but still really happy with their playing. The Pels are one game out from OKC. They've surged ahead of Phoenix, whose schedule looks really brutal now. I think it's fairly safe to say that, you know, this is a battle between the Pelicans and OKC, where I personally think OKC is a heavy favorite. But, you know, if Anthony Davis comes back soon or even by the next game, like, literally anything can happen. You get a player like that, you know, combined with guys playing really hard, and you could go on another long winning streak. So, couple games coming up over the next few days. I mean, this team has a stretch of, what did we say, 5 games in 7 days?
Yeah, including, I mean, Wednesday is the first game, and they have 4 games between Wednesday and Monday.
Yeah.
And then Tuesday they have another game right after. So our next podcast, we're going to have 4 games to talk about again. And they're going to be playing a game the day right after. And then they have a rest, finally. After that Tuesday game, they don't play again until Sunday.
Yeah, I mean, the good news is 3 of them are at home. Mm-hmm. That last one, the Memphis game at home, is a back-to-back. But Memphis will also be coming off a back-to-back, which is really rare that we get a team when they're on a back-to-back.
Two more. We'll have it happen 2 more times the rest of the season.
Yeah, including that Memphis game. So, yeah, 3 there. You got a Milwaukee team that's not nearly as good after the trade. You know, a Brooklyn team that we already saw. I wouldn't say, I mean, I think that the Dallas game tonight was a borderline unwinnable game. I don't think any of these 5 are, you know, at all. You know, which one would you like to talk about?
I think I'll go Milwaukee, because Milwaukee is interesting to me. They're a strange team. They have actually the same, or they before tonight they had the same record we do. So I'll take Milwaukee. That's the last of the 4. So which one are you going to take? And we'll talk about that one first.
I think I'll take the Celtics.
Okay.
The Celtics have won 3 in a row. They were killing. I mean, they were killing Golden State by 26 in the first half the other day, and, you know, Golden State came back to win. But yeah, I mean, Jared Sullinger basically went down for them, and they've just been going with a heavy guard rotation. They play with a ton of energy, attack the basket. Isaiah Thomas has been absolutely fantastic since coming to the Celtics. I mean, I think this is a game that a lot of people are going to go into thinking that the Pelicans are the heavy favorite, but especially if Anthony Davis is not back at this point, you know, I can't agree that they are. I think, you know, Boston has a lot of weapons. Like I said, Isaiah Thomas has been averaging about 22 points per game since joining the Celtics, and he's coming off the bench. Evan Turner's been playing better as of late. You've got two guys who could really pressure the ball, and Avery Bradley, and of course Marcus Smart. Jay Crowder is a guy who, keep listening to his name now, because he's going to be a guy that I keep bringing up in the offseason as a potential MLE target. You know, he's basically, to me, Damari Carroll without the three-point shot yet, but still a better three-point shot than Carroll left Utah with, so it's possible it's there. I mean, they just have a lot of young, hungry guys, and people who think they're tanking, you know, just aren't informed or thinking that they're the Celtics that we assume they'd be going in to the season. This team is fighting hard for the playoffs, and they are playing, I mean, they're a lot like us. They are maybe a little undermanned and under-talented right now, but they are playing so hard every night, and I just do not want people going into this game assuming that it's going to be an easy Pelicans win.
It's actually kind of surprising when you take a look at them, like how efficient some of their players are at scoring too. Like I always had the impression of Brandon Bass that he was like Mr. Mid-range jump shot. That was pretty much what he did, and he was okay at it, but he never really was that efficient of a scorer. But this year he's better than normal. He's over 1.2 points per shot, which puts him into the pretty solid range. He's getting a little bit of free throw line work. I mean, Kelly Olynyk he's 35% from downtown. There's just like a bunch of weird players that probably get partly underrated by whoever they're facing a lot of the time too.
Yeah, throw
Tyler Zeller. Yeah, I mean, it's just a weird team, and you know. And it has some players that aren't good, but on individual nights, they can be good. Like, would it really shock you if we went in to play Boston and Evan Turner dropped 16 points and 8 rebounds on you?
No, not the way he's playing lately. And you can't underestimate, this surge has also happened the second that they traded Marcus Thornton. Getting that poison out of your system is good for any team.
Oh, poor Marcus. He just keeps moving everywhere. I mean,
and yet it's kind of sad. I still read people saying that they can't believe we traded him for Carl Landry. Blows my mind.
So let's talk Milwaukee. So the Bucks have not played well since the trade. You mentioned that a little earlier that they basically traded away Brandon Knight, who was playing a hell of a lot better than he had earlier in his career. He was a fairly efficient scorer, but he was also at the stage where basically he was entering restricted free agency. So someone was going to pay him, and Milwaukee's not in the point right now where they feel like paying anybody. They're still rebuilding their team, so they basically cashed him out and brought in Michael Carter-Williams from the 76ers, who has a little bit more time before they have to pay him the big contracts. The funny part is like Carter Williams hasn't actually played that awful while he's been there. It's just that it's more of a fit thing. Brandon Knight was a good offensive player, which gave them one good offensive player they could run plays for, and now they're down to a couple mediocre guys. Like, you know, Giannis Antetokounmpo. He is an amazing player to watch, but you don't give him the ball and have him score. Like, that's just not what you're going to get out of him at all. He is completely complimentary at this point. And the rest of their team is all, like, Chris Middleton has been highly efficient this year, but he is also pretty highly dependent on being the second point of attack. Someone else breaks the defense, and then he takes advantage of it either by shooting or driving afterwards. And so they're kind of reliant on someone like Jared Bayless coming off the bench and having one of his big scoring moments where he's not being inefficient, or O.J. Mayo coming in and actually hitting some of his shots. And that happens so infrequently. They're entirely a defensive team. that's the fun part is this team is the second best defense in the league. I mean, they're really good. I look at their team and I'm like, Giannis is, I could see him being turned into a good defender. Plumlee can be energy guy, but he just got there. Henson's a good defender, but Bayless, Mayo, Dudley, Middleton, Ilyasova, these aren't names that strike fear into my heart as a defense. Like, you got to give Kidd credit. Like, I've wanted to mock him as a coach because of the way he deals with people, and he's always trying to grab more power, but he put in a pretty good situation here that's paying dividends on the defensive end.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of reminds me a little bit of what Steve Clifford did with Charlotte last year.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they've definitely bought in, and, you know, that happens with new coaches sometimes, especially young guys or hungry guys or franchises that haven't won in a while. And, you know, they're doing it simply by turning people over a lot, which, you know, is obviously with their length. And I think their length gives people a lot of problems in a lot of different ways. So, yeah, it's an interesting team. I'm looking forward to seeing, you know, kind of how they look now post-trade. I think Brandon Knight was just an absolutely perfect guy for the way that this roster is constructed. And I think that maybe you could have debates. I would never be on the Michael Carter-Williams side, but I think maybe people could have debates over who, you know, the better player could be. And people might be like, oh, the Bucks got younger with Michael Carter-Williams. They'd be wrong, because those two guys are the same age. Yeah. And, you know,
I'm 100% convinced it's got to be financial. Like I said earlier, it's got to be just the fact that they didn't want to pay Brandon this summer. Like,
right.
He's headed to probably a near max contract.
Right, which will be nothing compared to what Carter will get when he's rookie. I mean, Carter's rookie deal will be over in the new money era.
Mm-hmm.
I would rather pay a guy, you know, I would quote unquote overpay a guy now, because an overpay now, well, I mean, let's say Brandon Knight gets $14 million a year. In the new cap, that's equivalent to, you know, whatever, 9 to 10 now. When Michael Carter-Williams' contract is up, he will be getting a percentage of the new cap. So I guess I just don't see that, especially when you have the money to pay now, because so many of your guys, I mean, Parker and Antetokounmpo are on their rookie contracts now. Why would you want to pay all of your guys at the same time? I would rather get Knight over with now and, you know, have him on a reasonable deal when it's time to give my extensions to Antetokounmpo and Parker. It's just, I thought the same thing at the time, but whoever's managing, you know, the money and the cap, I don't think thought about what I just said, because I honestly think that hurts them in a way.
Yeah.
So anyway, yeah, I think it'll be an interesting game. So, you know, it seems like Dudley, there was really nothing, you know, on the X-rays, but Dudley probably will be gone for this game. They're being a little cautious with him just because of his injury last year. So, you know, I think it'll be an interesting one. I really don't know how to predict all of these Pelicans games, because I don't know how many schedule losses are going to be here. I mean, 7 games in 10 days with, you know, a couple of them being back-to-back and 2 road back-to-backs, and your team is shorthanded already. Like, that's kind of brutal.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't really know how to, you know, predict these games, because they're not really, you know, coming in a vacuum. They're coming in the midst of this really weird stretch.
We don't know when Anthony Davis is going to come back either.
That's,
and even necessarily how effective he'll be once he gets back. So we're still going to make your prediction. It's versus Detroit, versus Boston, versus Memphis, and at Milwaukee. What is our record?
I'm going to go 2-2. I think you split the first two and split the last two. I don't really know exactly where. If I had to guess, I would say win versus Detroit, loss Boston, loss Memphis, win Milwaukee. But I have no confidence in picking a win or a loss in any of those four games.
I'm going 1-3.
Wow.
I think that Davis is probably not going to be back for the first couple games, and I think that I'm not sold that it's sustainable having role players pick up like that much slack. I'm thinking the win is either going to come against Detroit or Memphis.
Yeah, and I mean, you talked a little bit about Davis, like. I mean, we saw last year the Pelicans kind of ease him back in after returning from injury and actually bringing him off the bench against the Clippers. Do you ease him in at all, whether it's minutes-wise, starting-wise, or even since the team will play a couple of back-to-backs, maybe, you know, not play him as much in back-to-backs or even sit him for the second game? I mean, what do you do with his minutes when he comes back?
If he gets, the risk is him just getting hit. So you just decide how many minutes you're going to play him and play him, whether it doesn't matter if he starts or not. He's going to be in there. And honestly, if you play him against second-tier players, they're probably more likely to hit him than the first-tier players. So I wouldn't mess with him coming off the bench and working their way back in. I would just decide he's going to play 24 minutes tonight, and he's starting, and he just gets his 8 minutes per quarter, which is really bad math, 6 minutes per quarter.
Yeah, it'll be interesting. I'm hoping. I mean, we heard reports that he had a really good workout before the game today. Obviously, my hope would be he gets a little rust off against Detroit. Then he's full go against Boston. Because, you know, I think if we have any chance of winning that Memphis game, he's going to have to be big. So, you know, the hope is we hear Tuesday that he had a full practice. Wednesday shakes some of the rust off. And then from Friday on, we have full AD for the rest of the season.
It'll be nice. So thanks, everybody, for listening to In the Know. And we'll be back in a week. Hopefully we'll be somewhat cheerful again.